Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top reporters. Their questions, please remember, do not necessarily reflect their point of view. It is their way of getting behind the headlines. Now here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Mr. Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Miss Barbara Ward, world famous as an economist, political scientist, and writer on world affairs. She is in this country on a Carnegie grant to study the foreign aid program and to conduct a seminar at Harvard University on aid to underdeveloped countries. She is a former editor of the London Economist. In that position, she earned a reputation as one of the most influential writers in England. In the 300-year history of Harvard University, only four women have received honorary degrees. Miss Helen Keller was the first, Miss Ward was the second. She is the only woman ever to address a Harvard commencement. For the last 5 years, Miss Ward has lived and taught in what is now the African Republic of Ghana. Her husband, Sir Robert Jackson, is economic advisor to the Ghana government. Miss Ward's latest book, Five Ideas That Changed the World, has been widely discussed and widely quoted. Now seated around the press table, ready to interview Miss Ward, are John Scott of Time and Life magazines, Krishna Balaraman of the newspaper Hindu of India, Clifton Daniel of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Miss Ward, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Miss Ward, I know you've been concerned with India's economic problem. The other day, the Ford Foundation issued a report on India and said that India is heading for disaster unless she can increase her food output by 57% during the next 7 years. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Yes, I think that this is an absolutely accurate statement of India's first responsibility. And it isn't only a question here of increasing food supplies, important as that is in the relationship of rising birth rate to resources, but there's another factor too. And that is, I think, most economists have now agreed that unless you get a really dynamic economic structure in your agricultural sphere, you simply aren't going to get the growing market and the growing dynamism that you need for industry to expand as well. In other words, the push in agriculture is one of the things you need for your growth of industry at the same time. So the two things hang together.
Miss Ward, as a student of India, do you think the solution of India's economic problems with the help of Western aid will guarantee that India will not become communist-dominated?
Well, if you'll give me one moment on this, because I think this touches the really crucial problem, it's this. You cannot modernize agriculture, and you can't get an industrial system going in a big way without saving capital. Now in China, next door, the communists are using the totalitarian method of making the peasants save. We've been reading all about it. They're being forced into communes, the whole of the agricultural surplus being squeezed off from the countryside into the towns. The advantage of this is that it creates saving. The disadvantage is that it destroys the hope of freedom. Now in India, where you've got extreme pressure of population, a great difficulty of saving, because if people have low incomes, they don't have much to save with. India is committed to the method of persuasion and to the method of taking the farmer along. Therefore, it can't use the crash methods of political force. And so I think India, in these crucial periods, needs economic assistance from outside so that it does not have to take these absolutely draconian methods of saving. And this is, to me, the great drama in Asia. Can we help India to maintain the liberal methods and to avoid this absolute forced totalitarian method of saving? If we can do that, then India can continue in its own way, which is that of the open society and not totalitarian control.
Well, do you think that India can get the food that she needs without government controls, with an open society that you speak of? Or is she going to have a great many government controls in order to get what she needs?
No, I don't think this, because it seems to me that if you've got a really lively development program in the villages, which, of course, costs money. This costs capital in the form of Fertilizers, new seed, new methods. It costs capital in the shape of educators, people who go out into the villages. But if you can get some capital help, then I think the persuasiveness of good agricultural methods can, in time, say 10 years, can persuade more farmers to join in, and you can get movement and dynamism in the villages by what I believe is known in some parts of America as show-me agriculture. They'll do it if they see it's a success. But this means proving that it can be done.
Mr. Daniel.
Miss Ward, what do you see as the ultimate result if China should win? What is, in effect, a race between China and India to modernize themselves in Asia?
I think the risk, Mr. Daniels, is a very simple one, and that is that the peoples of Asia, and indeed of Africa as well, who are coming up behind, will come to the conclusion that in economies in the 20th century, there is no way, save that of totalitarian control and planning, to get them through to modernization. Well, and as they have to modernize, I fear they will choose the totalitarian way.
Miss Ward, we in the United States, as I'm sure you're aware, in something of a dilemma. Pakistan is our ally and almost directly allied with us through the Baghdad Pact. With India, we're very sympathetic. We give aid to them both in different ways and in different measure. The Indians and Pakistans claim that we're supporting one against the other. Now, what are we to do about that problem?
Well, I think one thing we could do right away, and it would be a very important one, and that is to put directly some capital into solving the big rivers problem. As you know, this is one of the most crucial economic issues which divide Pakistan and India. They've had to divide their great river basin in the north, where the five rivers are the great source of agricultural wealth, and the method of transfer of waters from one part of the country, from the Indian side to the Pakistan side, does involve a great deal of capital expenditure to make up for the change in the irrigation system. And I think one proof we could give that we want these two countries to prosper and to work together would be if in the next 5 years we help them to solve the Punjab River's problem. This would be a big sign that we meant business for both countries.
At the same time, should we increase, decrease, or alter in any way our program of military aid to the Pakistanis?
Well, you open up there a very big question that goes far beyond economic assistance. It is my own profound conviction that, given the nature of the struggle against communism, that economic assistance is much, much, much more effective than military assistance.
Are you about to come to the point of recommending to the United States that we cut down our military assistance to all countries and concentrate on economic aid?
I wouldn't dream in many ways of giving direct advice to another government, but if the issue arose in Britain, I would say to the British government, you'll get much more out of economic assistance.
Mr. Balaraman.
Miss Ward, do you think that India is aware enough of our problem and is going all out to meet it? Does the progress India has made in the last 10 years give you reason to hope that she'll be able to surmount our economic problem?
I think in many ways the progress that India has made has been underestimated. She has done some fantastic jobs of rearrangement and reorganization in a situation where, having been partitioned, having had to resettle all the refugees, to get the whole country based upon a democratic system, the administrative problems alone of this whole effort have been absolutely terrific. In addition to that, of all the Asian countries, she is the one who, under democratic auspices, has produced a consecutive and thought-through plan, which has, in fact, succeeded in getting a 5% to 6% increase in national income each year. This against these terrific political difficulties. In other words, I think India has done a great deal to bring herself to what I would call the take-off point, as it were, of modernization, and that it's therefore infinitely worthwhile to give the extra boost that is needed at this stage.
One of the arguments I've heard here often is that against giving American aid is you don't give aid to a country which has a socialist system of government. And the argument is every American dollar goes to perpetuate socialism or foster socialism. Do you think there is any validity in it?
Well, strictly no, because 90% of the Indian economy is entirely under private auspices compared to the figure of about 75 to 80% in America. So I think the people have got their proportions a little wrong, I must say. But I would think the direct opposite is the truth. And for this reason. And that is that if India cannot secure by long-term development loans the kind of capital she needs to develop, she is bound to try and canalize more and more of her domestic savings under government control because she's no alternative. In other words, it is just precisely in the measure that she can look outside to get capital that she can allow her domestic savings to go into all manner of private channels, in which, in the last 5 years, they have been going with great vigor. Something like 60% of all savings in India has gone into the private sector.
Do you think this Tibetan adventure would have any impact on this competition between India and China for influencing opinion among the uncommitted nations?
Well, yes, certainly, just as in another part of the world, Hungary did. I don't think we can remind people too often that the issue behind Russia and China isn't so much communism as the fact that when they get too much influence, they take over. In other words, it's a pattern with which Asia is far too familiar, and that's the imperialist pattern. And I don't think we can underline this too often.
Mr. Scott.
Miss Ward, you earlier remarked that you thought that a greater degree of concentration in the agricultural sector was healthy for the development of underdeveloped areas. Mm-hmm. India currently is building 4 steel mills at the same time, which pinpoints the question I want to ask you. To what extent do you think we should impose strings on the aid which we give in order to create balances which seem more healthy for the economic development of the country involved?
Well, I think there are 2 answers to that. The short answer is yes, as long as it's private. Public strings, in fact, do no good at all. But if you have a healthy private working relationship with the government, there's an awful lot you can say in the way of advice that you can't say in any other manner. But I would like to stress this point, that you cannot hope, or we cannot hope, because Britain too has been concerned with development loans to India, we cannot hope to have this kind of influence and give this kind of advice if it's always on again, off again, Flanagan. In other words, we just simply don't know whether we're going to give them any help in 2 years' time. How can anyone try and get a sensible policy worked out if they don't know whether it's going to be there in 2 years? In other words, we could have far more constructive influence, I think, if we settled with ourselves the question of whether this is going to last or not.
The 5-year plan in India, however, you mentioned earlier that it had many great assets.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Krishnamachari came over here quite recently and wanted $2 billion in order to put the 5-year plan on its feet. He didn't get it all, but don't you think that in bankers' terminology, that for that sort of support, we ought to have the equivalent of a man on their board, as it were?
Yes, but as I say, this is also a political issue. I think you can do an awful lot quietly, which you can't do by spelling it out politically. And I also think that in this extra $2 billion, we ought to remember one thing. That is that part of that extreme emergency which arose last summer was due to the recession in the Western world and something of a collapse in India's export prices. Now, they didn't know this was going to happen. And in some measure, some of their difficulties arose from the decline in markets in the Western world during this period. So maybe they also would be able to say, well, look, you know, if we're going to make a success of this, can't we at least see that some of the export prices are a little more stable? And this, heaven knows, is a problem in Africa as well.
Are you disturbed, Miss Ward, by the methods that are being used contemporarily by Mr. Dr. Nkrumah in the country of your current residence in Ghana, which have involved pressures on the opposition, which some of his own citizens have characterized as unfortunate and perhaps unconstitutional?
Well, Mr. Scott, you put me in a dilemma here because I'm the wife of a public official of Ghana, and it's hard for me to comment. But I think one thing might be said usefully, and that is that any society just emerging from a very mixed tribal background has quite special problems of public order, as we've seen in other parts of Africa. And if you don't mind, I don't awfully want to go on with this one because I am in this particular position.
Mr. Spivak.
Miss Ward, one of the criticisms you seem to make of our foreign aid program is that it emphasizes too much our fight against communism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so?
Yes, I feel that profoundly, because...
Why do you think this is bad, since that really is one of the major issues in the world today, our fight against communism?
Well, it's partly an old strategic concept, which is that you're never good never at your best when you're on the defensive. And I think if we're always in the position of saying, you know, go and find out what Uncle Khrushchev is doing and telling him not to, then certainly we get the least effectiveness out of our own effort. But I have another reason, and that is that I think that nearly all the problems and revolutions which are sweeping the world have absolutely nothing to do with communism. They're built into the great technical and modernizing changes of the 20th century, and that they're going to happen even if there were no communists, and that we, as the originator of technical change, of industry, of science, of nationalism and democracy, we simply can't afford to sit by and see these great changes sweeping over the world and be quite indifferent to them.
Well, am I to understand that you believe that the economic threat of the communists then is greater than the military threat?
Yes.
To this underdeveloped world?
Well, I think the two things play into each other, certainly, for behind the economic threat is the sense of power. Don't let us underestimate the feeling of power in the world. But I certainly think that in a country like India, you're not going to have a massive invasion by Russian and Chinese forces, but you might get, under the failure of a plan, a sort of creeping anarchy, a collapse of hope, and much greater opportunities for communist subversion. I would think this is the great danger.
Well, why do you say you're not going to get a massive invasion? What assurance is there that you're not? What assurance is there that if they go into Tibet, they might not go into India also?
Well, Tibet is traditionally and recognizably part of the Chinese Empire, and I reckon they think if they went in massively into India, they might run into another Korean situation. It's a risk they can't take. In other words, this is where the power factor is important. But it's our power.
Mr. Daniel.
Miss Ward, I think in this country we feel that we face a challenge from communism, if you like, or Soviet imperialism. We certainly feel ourselves directly in competition these days with the Russians, and we've felt that particularly since they sent up the first Sputnik. Mm-hmm. You would agree with me, is a fact of life, isn't it?
Oh, certainly, certainly. But I think you deal with this kind of competition not by looking round your shoulder all the time, or our shoulder, because the Western world is in this together, not by looking round to see what they are doing, but by looking out into the world to see what we're going to do. I would like to have the communists wondering. For instance, during the brief, great period of the Marshall Plan, the communists lost ground in Europe, and for a time they were disoriented. They didn't know what to do about it. I would pray God to see the day again when they're just as worried as they were then. And I can't help feeling that if in the Western world we had the idea of making our main objective in foreign policy a sustained, shall we say, a free world investment program of $5 or $6 billion a year, 1% of national income, not ruinous, to make sure that the nations, the underdeveloped nations, come through this sound barrier of modernization. And if we were concerned with that, I think we would worry the communists in a way we don't worry them when we're always trying to find out what they're doing. What are we doing? I want them to have to find out.
I'm afraid I can't disagree with you, but I'd also like to have some further recommendations, for example, on the military sphere that Mr. Spivak raised. This is not only an economic question, is it?
No, certainly not, and I would never say that we could afford to have less than equality of power with Soviet Russia. This, I think, is absolutely basic, because if we were to arbitrarily disarm, we have disarmed to some extent, but if we went on, we might put ourselves into a position which we were vis-à-vis Hitler, where we simply aren't ready to contain the threat of force. But heavens! We are, after all, if you add us all together in the Western world, we are wealthy communities. We can afford to do this and do something else as well. And the other thing that I pray we'll do is to get this consistent long-term approach to world development and world growth and world investment, which heaven knows are exciting things, and then let the communists, let them worry what we're doing.
Well, would you like to intrude into American politics just a moment and tell us whether we need to have a balanced budget these days or whether we need to pay higher taxes?
Well, I think I agree with Mr. McElroy on the one hand, and who shall I pick on the other? Mrs. Stevenson on the other, and say you need to grow. And if you grow, you can do all these things. And if you don't, you won't. This, I think, is a non-partisan statement.
Miss Ward, right along that line, a few weeks ago on Meet the Press, the noted Harvard economist Dr. Sumner Schlichter said that an expanding economy cannot be achieved without some degree of inflation. I wonder, as an economist, whether you would agree with that.
I think it's true that when all resources are being used to the maximum, under perfectly free market conditions, you'll have some tendency for prices to go up, because when people are bidding for resources, and the resources are at a given moment used to the full pitch, there's only one thing the pressure can do, and that's shove the prices up a bit. This, I think, is true. On the other hand, I think that there are methods of putting some restraint on this process which do not contradict the free economy. For instance, when the Germans were doing a fantastic rate of growth from 1948 onwards, they had absolutely stable prices. And one reason was that the whole of the business structure, above all the unions, had had one runaway inflation, so they weren't in any way opposed to the idea that you had to have a measure of wage restraint. In other words, they had personal experience of it. Therefore, you had great growth and a measure of stability in prices. And I sometimes wonder whether both for Britain and for America, the great next step in our democratic economic theory isn't enough education to both managers and to our unions to say, okay, we're going to go on going up, but we're going to go on going up a little more slowly. In other words, wage contracts will be longer. They'll be related to productivity. We'll return to that wonderful old-fashioned mechanism, which has almost vanished, that of the price cut. In other words, that there is here a great area of democratic education to be done if we're going to get full-scale economic growth. I don't think it's beyond us, but I do think we have to think about it.
Mr. Balaraman.
Miss Ward, every assumption on which Marx propounded his communist theory has been exploded by the record of the capitalist system. How is it that communism still appeals after 100 years and still threatens to be the wave of the future? What is it which makes it keep going?
Well, Mr. Balaram, I don't think they've been entirely contradicted. You see, I think they've been contradicted in the Western world, where we've got through this sound barrier, if you like, of modernization. We've got the capital accumulation.
Mr. Balaraman.
Miss Ward, every assumption on which Marx propounded his communist theory has been exploded by the record of the capitalist system. How is it that communism still appeals after 100 years and still threatens to be the wave of the future? What is it which makes it keep going?
Well, Mr. Balaram, I don't think they've been entirely contradicted. You see, I think they've been contradicted in the Western world, where we've got through this sound barrier, if you like, of modernization. We've got the capital accumulation. We've been able to create the resources for a fuller life, and through things like progressive taxation and the welfare system, we've shared them with a great mass of the people. And for this reason, communism, I think, can no longer hope to conquer the Western world by anything but direct force. But when you get out to Asia and Africa, this isn't so. We haven't yet worked out a method whereby we can prevent these areas where the birth rate is going up and resources are still limited. They can still get poorer while we get richer. In other words, we could have the reconstruction of a Marxist situation, not in our own countries where it's absolutely exploded forever, but in the world at large. Here you might, under the pressure of rising population and of static resources, you might get per capita incomes going down, while in Britain we talk of doubling our standard of living in a generation. In America we talk of a $500 billion economy. In other words, we're going to get richer. So I think that if we're going to make the appeal of communism definitely fall away all around the world as it does in the West, we've got to use our own resources and our own inventiveness and imagination to bring the other nations up in our wake. If we can do that, I think the same thing will happen.
One of the sticks with which the communists are beating Western powers in Asia and Africa is this stick of Western colonialism. Would it help democracy's cause if some of the European powers who still have colonies in Africa and other parts of the world pulled out? It would silence the propaganda gun.
Well, they'd be awfully hard put to it to pull out of much of Asia, because they've jolly nearly pulled. I mean, you've got a few pockets left, like Goa, which is a troublesome one, or Hong Kong. But if you look at the Asian scene, there is one chapter that is dead and closed, and that's European colonialism. When you turn to Africa, I think we do have a problem here, but of a rather different kind. And that is that in the countries where colonial control is still a bitter, confusing problem, which is Algeria and Kenya and the Rhodesias, here you have a problem of white settlement and therefore of people living together of different race and different culture in the same society. Now, this is much more troublesome than the sheer removal of colonial control and demands more patience, more wisdom, and perhaps more understanding than we've shown.
Mr. Scott.
Miss Ward, you mentioned the increasing birth rate in the underdeveloped nations. Last year, I believe, the population of the world increased by some 45 million. Do you believe that we can cope with the economic problems of the underdeveloped nations for very long without some sort of scientifically designed and applied population control?
Well, I think that if we're going to go on with every family in the world having, say, 4 to 6 children, which is the pattern that may be coming in the United States, about the year 22,000, isn't it? Or 2200, sorry. As one scientist says, yes, by that time you'll be able to stoop down and make food of anything you pick up. But he said, will you be able to stoop down? That was his query. And so I would think that one form or another of control, either by voluntary means or by any other, is going to be necessary, certainly. And the quarrel, I think, is going to be about the means.
One other question, Miss Ward. Do you advocate joint aid programs between the Western powers and the Soviet Union if we could get the Soviet Union to agree to such joint programs?
Oh, I think pick out a few key things like the Nile Valley and challenge them to do it with us would be a magnificent way either of testing their good faith or taking some of the sting out of their programs. I'd be very much in favor of trying. But only if, meanwhile, we were doing the job ourselves.
Mr. Spivak.
Miss Ward, how long do you think it's going to be necessary for the West to continue with its aid programs? Is this something that has to go on forever?
Well, I think world investment has to go on because we've got to go on growing. That's in all our interests. But aid will depend on how soon other people can be helped to save for themselves.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to interrupt. Thank you very much, Miss Ward, for being with us. Meet the Press will return in just a moment. First, here is our announcer.
This is Professor Harvey E. White conducting an experiment in atomic age physics on Continental Classroom, carried by 149 stations of the NBC television network, viewed 5 times a week by nearly 300,000 early rising students from all walks of life, blessed with a faculty that includes 7 Nobel Prize winners, Continental Classroom is truly continental in scope, and in its origin and effect, international. For it was the challenge of Sputnik that inspired Continental Classroom, and if it in turn can inspire just one of its 300,000 students to delve further into nuclear physics, the entire world will benefit. NBC is pleased and proud that this year's Sylvania Award for the Best Public Service Series went to Continental Classroom, the world's largest classroom, conducted over most of these NBC stations.
Bye for Miss Barbara Ward and Meet the Press. For a printed copy of today's discussion, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to the National Publishing Company, Washington 2, D.C. Meet the Press is produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Associate producer, Betty Cole. Directed by Linwood King. Unit manager, Bruce Bassett. Technical director, Jack Irving. Production supervisor, Doris Corwith. Next week, Meet the Press will have as its guest another front page figure in the news. This is Howard Reig speaking. Meet the Press came to you from the NBC studios in New York. This program has been a public affairs presentation of NBC News.
Dinah welcomes Jean Berry, Janice Page,